Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal. Hi, John.
Hey, great to be with you.
And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. And a few of you have been saying hi to me in public lately, and I just want to let you know we so appreciate you listening.
Yeah, it's great to have you listening, and there was a lot of things going on. I'm going to start with marijuana.
What are you smoking?
Yeah, a little hooch. What President Biden did in the last week, it's got some layers to it, but essentially pardoned, what was it, 6,500?
The economist should know.
Federal, yeah.
No.
Federal prisoners who had a possession charge with marijuana.
Yes. So it's simple possession. So this means that this is the charge. So we're not talking about moving it across state lines, selling it. We're talking about simple possession.
Okay. And then asked governors to use their power to pardon the ones that are under state convictions, which our governor does not have the power to do. So that was a little off pitch for the president to ask our governor to do that. But, you know, John, I want to go to you first, just your reaction to this, because everyone immediately politicized it, said Biden's doing this to get votes. Even, you know, Governor Cox threw out that sort of comment. Where did you land on it?
So the timing... I think Biden should have done this a year and a half ago. So the timing is suspect. And I get why people are skeptical about the timing.
Campaign promise. He could have done it earlier.
Yeah. And you throw on, you know, student loans and all that type of stuff. And so, it's easy to be skeptical. I come from the perspective of, first of all, I'm not a legalized marijuana kind of guy, but I am a decriminalized marijuana. Leave it up to, for example, in Utah, between patients and their doctors. I do not think the federal government should be in the middle of all this stuff. I think they've caused too much harm as a result. So I do applaud the president for taking a first step down this path. But my question to him is now, what is he going to do to put pressure on Congress to decriminalize it? What is he going to do in terms of his drug agency to deal with the appropriate classification of marijuana? Because it's been unreasonable from my perspective. And largely, what is he going to do to get the federal government out of it? Because even the states that are dealing with it are running into banking issues and all sorts of other things like that that pose greater risk of crime and so forth in our states. Mm-hmm. And it's being driven by problems at the federal level.
Shireen, did you celebrate this when you heard about it?
Yeah. So this is, I think, long overdue. And as you're suggesting, I think it would have been nice to see this even earlier. But I can also have a timeline understanding that when Biden came into office, the place that we were at with the coronavirus, with everything else going on, I totally understand that sometimes things do not get prioritization. But what is happening when we're talking about possession, simple possession, is that we know Black and brown communities more likely bear the legal ramifications of the criminalization of having weed, right? Okay, so we know that there's a disproportionate number of Black and brown people in jail for having weed. We also know that this is an issue that simply is like confounding to me, because basically we have states that have legalized it. And so we act in some ways, in some places, like it is, but it creates a whole host of problems, including the fact that it is a scheduled drug, means that we don't have the opportunity to do medical research on it, to do drug testing on it, so that there's not good, we don't have accurate information. What you're hearing in weed stores, if you go into those, if you go out of state, or even here, the information that you get is the best information that people can give, but there isn't a certifying body that is in charge of that because of the way that we have criminalized marijuana in this country. This is a social justice issue, and when I say that, I mean I think it's the right thing to do in terms of shifting back on the disproportionate burden that Black and brown people have taken in suffering the consequences in our criminal legal system. But I also just think we have to understand most people's attitudes in this country have really changed on weed. And this is in line with the vast majority of Americans. And I do think that it was the right thing to do.
My complaint with the reaction was that everybody immediately said he's doing it for political reasons, or they criticized him for doing it by executive order, when I wish we could have talked about the policy of it.
Yeah,
like
sure.
You just were doing.
Yeah.
And the policy of it, to me, I don't like marijuana being legalized. I think it's bad for your workforce. I think it's bad for kids. I think it's a gateway drug, all those things. But do I think by having possession you should spend time in a federal penitentiary? I don't.
Yeah.
And somehow we miss the policy discussion.
Well, we miss the policy discussion. And then the other thing is we throw on different things. And I'll take issue with the governor here. He throws out a disregard for checks and balances. Mm-hmm. Well, the simple fact is the president can pardon people. That is one of his checks on over-criminalizing certain things. And so this actually is part of checks and balances.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, great point. Hey, let's go to Saudi Arabia and the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. Whoa, is this complicated. You got the fist bump that happened.
You also have MBS, like the Saudi government murdering an American journalist. Jamal Khashoggi was murdered brutally by this government.
Yeah.
And then we show up and fist bump them.
And then you have OPEC reducing production, so prices rise as we're going into a very terrible time for Europe in terms of, you know, cold winter.
With the allegation they're doing it to prop up Russia.
Yeah, and it finances the Russian war. And you got to think that the State Department is in a tizzy right now.
They absolutely should be. This relationship is terrible, and there are many ways that we could put further constraints on Saudi Arabia or constraints on Saudi Arabia. We could stop selling them as many arms as we do. We could stop funding their war in Yemen. We could supporting, I guess I should say. There are many things that we could do in this context, but I do think that we continue to be held hostage by autocrats who have oil because we have not moved quickly enough for other solutions.
Question for both of you, that we've got some members of Congress that are trying to block U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Apparently, these are weapons that have a lot of technology, and, you know, it's a real bonus, I guess, for the U.S. to share our weapons technology with an ally like Saudi Arabia. Would you support a weapons ban to them, John? And I'll ask you the same question, Shereen.
I'm going to say it would depend. It would depend on the type of weapon and stuff like that. There is an element of trying to have stability in the Middle East, and there is a benefit to them doing that. But when it comes to, you know, gas, I would basically drill them into the ground. And what I mean by that is we have the ability to produce here. We should be producing and supplying the world and drying up their market. And that is the best way I would compete with Saudi Arabia. Now, I get Shereen and I will disagree some of the dynamics of energy transition and so forth. But from my perspective, that is the best way for America to respond.
Yeah, Shereen, would you be in line to stop weapon sales to Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I kind of lean that way as well.
Yeah.
All right. We also had Biden this week basically say that Putin's not joking about the threat to use nuclear weapons. The thought here is tactical nuclear weapons that are, I guess, more contained, whatever. But let me just read the quote. Biden said, "For the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, we have a direct threat of the use of nuclear weapons if, in fact, things continue down the path they are going." Then a little later, he said, "Putin is not joking when he talks about potential use of tactical nuclear weapons or biological or chemical weapons because his military is, you might say, significantly underperforming."
He's losing.
Yeah, Shereen. So you got Putin getting into more and more of a corner.
Do you remember
what happened,
the Cuban
next?
Missile Crisis? I mean, I was too young, so I learned about it in history class
in
and stuff like that.
I learned about it in a movie, and I don't remember it. But I've been to Cuba, and I've seen the airplane that they shot down that was a U.S., you know, plane.
Yeah,
and
yeah, but
they
this, how,
big
this is how long ago it is that most folks don't even know about it. Maybe they've heard about it in history.
Yeah.
Well, I would just say if you want a little insight into it, I highly recommend watching The Fog of War, great documentary where they do talk about it quite extensively. But I would just say this is Putin is losing this war. Okay, he's losing significant low morale. Doesn't have the troops that he needs. The bombing of a bridge is not only creating complications for moving supplies for the Russian army, but it's also a direct attack on Putin, who was very proud of this bridge.
His crown jewel.
Like,
got bombed on his birthday.
Wow. That's right. I mean, this is it is, though, in the larger context of the Ukrainian military really advancing and taking back places that have been claimed now by Russia, right? So this whole situation, I just continue to feel like we are on the precipice of things could really, I have no prediction, but what I would say is it's my attention is here and I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen next because it feels like it's certainly escalating.
Yeah, John.
Well, and Biden even used the word Armageddon in his comments
and
stuff, which is pretty strong.
As an aide to an elected official, I would say just do not ever use that in your vocabulary. That would be my instinct.
Well, I think this is why probably some of his staffers were like, this wasn't what we were expecting. Roll it back. State Department was probably freaking out at him making these comments, which is going to, you know, heighten and hyper-focus some of the concerns on this stuff. But yeah, Shereen's absolutely right. We are in a very dangerous situation with Putin, who is very, very unpredictable, and
cornered.
He wants to win, and he's cornered, and he's flailing around for relevancy. And, you know, clearly He's basically imposed a draft.
People have been fleeing the country.
People have been fleeing the country, but he's been compelling people to fight his war. They don't want to fight his war. They're not trained to fight the war, other things like that. And clearly, the Ukraine people are turning the tide in this thing, which is going to make him feel even more cornered. And he's going to lash out because he has to feel strong. He has to be perceived as strong. He can't be perceived as weak. And right now, I don't see an escape plan for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's troubling. Shireen, tell us what's going on in Iran.
So right now in Iran, there are massive protests that have been going on for weeks now, which started over the murder by the morality police, right? Security forces that killed a woman named Mahsa Amini, and she is Kurdish. She was, I believe, visiting the capital. Anyway, had her hair exposed and was taken by the morality police, who were saying that, you know, the hair exposure is against law, and took her, and she was killed. She was beaten to death and killed. And so massive protests, outpouring of resistance to the Iranian regime, the government, the morality police. And at this point, I think conservative estimates have said that, you know, an additional 40 or 50 people have died, but people in Iran are saying the number is much higher than that. And what is incredible about these protests is, though there have been protests, it feels like every few years for the Iranian people to really have freedom from this oppressive regime. This one is being led by women. And the images that you are seeing of just the incredible defiance and bravery in the face of what is, potentially death. And we're seeing it over and over again. People as young as 16-year-old girls being killed by the police. So this is I would say, just a massive moment where, if you aren't at all familiar with Iran or what's going on there, you can find lots of places across media that are reporting on this. And I would just encourage people to get educated, and there are places to get connected and offer support.
Thanks for that update, Shireen. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've got John Dougal and Shireen Gorbani here in the studio. In our next segment, we're going to talk about local politics. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we're going to talk about local politics. And I think as a starting point, let's just talk about the Utah Debate Commission and debates. And John, you'd mentioned that
you moderated one debate. I want to know kind of what it's like behind the scenes as a moderator. you've been at them. I just want to know from your perspective what it's like. You know, we've talked briefly about trying to put them together, but what's it like to prepare? Who writes the questions? All that type of stuff.
The way I think of it is, I think of the Utah Debate Commission as one of our institutions in Utah. In other words, something that we've agreed to do, that it's the right thing for our polity to have an independent commission that helps feature the marketplace of ideas and keeps it, you know, really independent and whatnot. Olene Walker was a mentor of mine, and she was one of the founders. So I'm a huge supporter of the Utah Debate Commission. And what happens in my world is I'll get a call or an email and they'll say, hey, would you be willing to be considered to be a moderator? Then a little bit later,
the short list.
Yeah, something. And a little bit later, they say, hey, we'd like you to do this. Are you available on this date? Because dates are really important in debates, because people will try to change them and things. And the commission needs to be responsible for the dates.
So you moderated the third congressional
district.
Down at BYU, right?
Uh-huh. And essentially, I just... I had a ton of independence. I just basically kind of thought about the director of the Utah Debate Commission gave me a sampling of a lot of issues that were, of interest. And I basically wrote my own script. And then I just gave it to a producer, because when you're doing it, you have to have the timing right, and you're turning to a student, you're turning to a reporter. So a producer is helping me to keep things on schedule. But, you know, I felt as a – so, you know, my background's in public policy, and I was just given the ability to create an independent, rigorous discussion. And I ended up having candidates that were just terrific. They were respectful of each other and very substantive.
Yeah.
So the commission didn't write the questions. The commission didn't screen the questions. They gave you some topics.
Okay. Yeah.
And would you say there was anything that came out of that debate that surprised you or things that you think are important for? And I should say, all of these are available on, you can go on YouTube and find them. They were broadcast, and they're also, I do think our local public radio runs them as well. So they get a much wider audience than a lot of other kind of debates or forums.
I know some are on TV, and yeah, Channel 2 has it on their auxiliary channel.
Yeah.
It was, I moderated the 3rd Congressional District. This would be John Curtis and Glenn Wright from... he's a Summit County commissioner. And what happened for me, Shereen, as I was in the studio and listened to them, first of all, they were respectful of each other. It was exactly what it's designed to do, to put out your best and create differences, meaning policy differences, express the policy differences you
have. So your civility index probably would have given, what, 6s or 7s or something
that,
high scores?
Well, and they did them. Yeah, if you can go look, you can go see them. So it was very respectful. And then they were clear contrasts.
Yeah.
They were different on abortion. They were different on debt. They were different on, just the way that the role of government in our lives.
Yeah.
So you kind of saw, if you will, that Republican versus Democratic view, probably.
Yeah. You got to see, which ones you could agree with, student debt, national debt. We talked about those sorts of issues. So it brings us to the situation we find ourselves in this week, where we've had some other debates. They've been successful, but we've got the 4th Congressional District, and we've got Burgess Owens on the day of the debate saying, I won't show up, and calling the Salt Lake Tribune the racist Salt Lake Tribune, taking issue with a political cartoon by Pat Bagley that was in April of 2021. Shereen.
Yeah,
give more color commentary.
Unwilling
here.
To debate Darlene McDonald, a fantastic candidate in this district, who, and I just have to say that the leading up to this, it has not been clear that Representative Owens is going to be at this debate. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's quite suspect that we get this announcement today that the reason he's not going to do it is because he's taking issue with the moderator, the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, over a cartoon, as you said, that came out quite a while ago now. It feels quite convenient to me as an excuse not to show up. And I do think it is.
In the most high-profile debate of the election season.
I think it's
season.
Disrespectful yeah. to the voters of this state to not engage in this platform, especially when he has had this information for weeks, has not confirmed his participation at all, right? Comes out with this statement today. And there could have been potentially, I don't know, negotiations about that if the issues would have been raised earlier. To me, this is absolutely dodging responsibility for the frankly, the election lies that he spreads, the quite extremist views that he holds. And I think it's convenient for him not to have to answer questions.
Yeah. John, how do you see it differently coming from the right?
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to say is we're recording this before the debate's actually taken place. So not sure exactly what turns out, but I do think we need to point out the nature of the political cartoon. It labeled Burgess as a member of the KKK.
It did not. It does not. We looked at it. Nope.
Okay.
There is a panel that has a KKK member that says, these people are coming into your neighborhood. Okay. And then there's a panel with him that says the same thing, which he did say about immigrants.
Okay. So he's talking as if this was portrayed about him, that he was a member of that. So that's how he's taken it and said that this is the same hate group that terrorized his family and his race when he was young in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see how he could take this hyper-personalized mm-hmm. with somebody from the Salt Lake Tribune. Now, mm-hmm. I do wonder if there would have been a different moderator, if that might have altered things and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of me that wonders about that.
Are you coming out on the day of the debate? Like, this started bothering you today?
I have no idea, for him and those dynamics. I'm not on the other side.
Point,
I don't know.
Your point is that it's understandable why he would have a bad reaction to the political cartoon.
Sure.
Totally get that.
And then to what Natalie just described about her experience. Okay, this is the person who's writing the questions now. So you're
but
already
not the
coming,
cartoonist, to be clear.
No.
Not the cartoonist.
The person from the Tribune.
Right.
I'm mm-hmm. talking about the organization. Mm-hmm. And so this is the person that's now going to write the questions in a debate in which my understanding is there is 3 people now scheduled to be in that debate. The United Utah candidate is also supposed to be in it. But it's one of these kind of dynamics. Now, from my perspective, I get that when you're in the lead, there's usually nothing but downside mm-hmm. in the debates.
Yeah.
And there's always concern about that. I wish there would have been some way to resolve it. So he would have been there on the debate stage and we would have seen that, fully mm-hmm. play out.
This is where I come in the political middle. I have so much respect for the Utah Debate Commission and for the important role they play in our community that I feel like if you're a member of Congress or if you put your name on a ballot, you have an obligation, you have a responsibility of your privilege of serving or of your citizenship to participate in something that helps voters get to understand you and know you. And you and can you, feel that way about the moderator, but you can say it in the debate.
Yeah.
Right. And I have a difference here than I did during the primary. In the primary, I thought the debate commission was improperly injecting themselves mm-hmm. into a party function, mm-hmm. where in this case, it's a different situation.
Yeah.
I also just think that you don't have, if you are elected in many of the districts in the state, you don't have to do anything because of, and I would say in the case of our congressional districts, because of extreme partisan gerrymandering, he has less to answer to now than he did under the previous drawings of this district, which were more, it was a more competitive yeah. district. So he can do whatever he wants. And frankly, many of our politicians can escape what would be considered the correct thing to do in service to our community because of how far things are tipped in the direction of that person likely winning anyway. I just think it's a disservice to democracy overall.
Yeah. Well, so then you also have Representative Curtis, Representative Stewart, Senator Lee all coming out in support of Burgess Owens, that hit this step, which I take issue with, but that's just me. But Congressman Moore and Senator Romney do not. I mean, they may take issue with it, but they didn't sign
say
a thing
anything.
And saying, you know.
Yeah.
So we've got division in the congressional delegation. We've got an attack at our, paper record, if you will. And then we have a congressman who's most deeply offended, I guess, by a political cartoon. All right. Let's go to the McMullen race just a little bit. Senator Lee.
You mean the Lee race.
Okay, I was going McMullen-Lee race, but Senator Lee is on the Tucker Carlson show on Fox TV, and he basically calls out Mitt Romney and says, it's not too late, Mitt. You can join the party. Endorse me. Senator Romney's thing is he's friends with both candidates. He's going to let it just go. John, your party, what do you think?
I don't watch Tucker Carlson, so I'm not sure the dynamics and how it was portrayed. You know, this uh-huh. could be Senator Lee having fun and,
I would
whatever.
Is,
but, you know, it's one of those things of, hey, it's not too late to join and stuff like that. But he's out there pitching himself, making the argument for his race, what he can do in the Senate.
As a Republican, does it bother you that the junior senator is not publicly endorsing the senior senator of the same party?
Not necessarily, because you got to remember, I'm a guy that doesn't endorse very many people.
Okay.
Typically, I'm endorsing one or two people per election cycle. Uh-huh. I am not laundry list like some folks of I'll endorse everybody and stuff like that. So when somebody chooses not to endorse, it's not highly offensive from my perspective.
From the outside, any commentary you want to make?
I would just say if you consider yourself a Mitt Romney Republican, I would highly suggest that this fall you should be an Evan McMullen voter.
Mm. So Donald Trump weighed in, said Mitt Romney has abused Mike Lee by not endorsing him, and he continues to call McMullen McMuffin.
Yeah, so this is exactly why. Donald Trump wants Mike Lee to hold this office. And Mike Lee, as you remember, said, I'm spending 14 hours a day trying to figure out how to keep you in office, Donald Trump. This is not a person to me who deserves this office. And I do feel deeply offended by the way that he comports himself, Mike Lee, Senator Lee. And I really would love to move in a direction of what I think is greater civility, more opportunity for Utah to get in the mix, to have a senator who's actually got some ability to work with people across the aisle to get things done for Utah. And that would be Evan McMullen.
Well, we've talked in the past about how Mike Lee reaches across the aisle with Bernie Sanders and other folks like that. So
and
we have
basically
various examples of him trying to work and collaborate with lots of folks. But, you know, if Utahns are sitting there facing the question of, do you want the Biden agenda for your future? What was it? 59% of Utahns are basically disagreeing with President Biden and his agenda. Mm-hmm. They do not want that. I think they're going to recognize when it comes to the vote for the U.S. Senate, a vote for McMullen is really a vote for the Biden agenda from
it
their perspective.
It simply is not. If you listen to anything he says, he is a conservative.
I want to just hear
from what I hear.
Both of you what you're predicting. The most recent poll had Lee at 41%, McMullen at 37%, very close, but 12% in the undecided. I'm going to say that Lee wins running away. But like I'm going to go like a 10-point victory.
Okay, I will just say again, if you have been dissatisfied with Mike Lee, this is your opportunity to vote for something else. And a person who is not a Democrat, he has never been a Democrat, and is I would just say, when we think about what is on the line in this election, to me, it is the institution of democracy. We have a person on the record, Mike Lee, who was willing to overthrow an election to have Donald Trump stay in power. That is not who Evan McMullen is.
John, I'm smiling because I said, who do you think is going to win? And Shireen made her point for who vote for.
That's right. That's right. She didn't play that. So who do you think is going to win?
I think it's going to be Evan, because I'm a Utah Democrat, I am forever optimistic.
Yeah, that's right. Forever optimistic.
John, what do you predict?
So you're telling me there's a chance.
There's
is that what
chance.
You're saying?
There's a chance. And if we all, if the people who are unaffiliated, the people who are independent, the Republicans who are tired of these games, there are enough votes.
We're like 20 seconds here, John, but what do you predict?
Well, at the end of the day, I think it's Mike Lee. The simple fact is you look and say inflation's high. There's lots of economic uncertainty. Gas prices are still high. The looming threats of war out there. Utahns are concerned about Joe Biden's agenda for America, and they're going to look and say they want somebody fighting against that.
Yeah, mail out ballots.
With
you'll
no
see,
ideas
you'll see
on
them
how to
soon,
solve it.
Voters. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal, Shireen Gorbani. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening to our discussion.